for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Medical experts, government advisors, and advocacy groups are meeting here in Washington to help finalize a draft national plan to tackle Alzheimer's disease. Here with me, Robert Egge of the Alzheimer's Association, Deborah Rubenstein of Iona Senior Services, and Dr. Scott Turner of Georgetown University Medical Center. But first, we'll go to Howard Koh. He's Assistant Secretary for Health at the Department of Health and Human Services. He's taking time out from the meeting to speak to us on the phone. Good morning, sir. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Would you tell us about the National Alzheimer's Plan, the role of this particular meeting in helping to develop the plan?
Sure. We all understand that Alzheimer's disease is a major challenge for the country and for patients and their families. And until now, we have not had a unified national effort to address this challenge. So a year ago, the president signed the National Alzheimer's Project Act into law. And through his commitment, this law requires our Department of Health and Human Services to establish the first ever National Alzheimer's Plan. And this will coordinate research and services and accelerate treatments and hopefully galvanize the country to do more in the future. So at this point, we have a draft framework for that plan. Through the Act, a very important advisory committee was established. We have that advisory council meeting right now to weigh in on this draft plan. And through the input from experts, but also particularly from patients and families, we want to finalize this plan in the very near future and really move forward as one nation to address this challenge.
Give me an idea of some of the specific goals of the plan.
Well, there are a number of major ambitious goals for the plan to optimize care for patients, to bolster support not only for patients but also for families and caregivers who are experiencing tremendous burdens, not just emotional but also financial with respect to care of loved ones. We want to enhance public awareness because there is unfortunately still a stigma related to this condition. We want to track progress over time, of course, and the most important overriding goal is to prevent and effectively treat Alzheimer's disease by 2025. So that's the framework moving forward.
And I was interested in that year of 2025. Why not set the goal earlier?
Well, we want the goal to be aspirational but also achievable. And this is an area where important work has been done in many parts of the planning for the future, but we haven't had an opportunity to really unify yet. So this is the first time to unify around one set of goals and one plan. So we feel that 2025 is both an aspirational but achievable goal.
It sounds to me as though this is a plan, as you said, to educate the public, to make sure that people understand that it should not be stigmatized. But where is the money going to come from in terms of, for example, financial help for those caregivers?
Sure. Well, we really understand and respect that there's tremendous need throughout the country, and we understand that Alzheimer's imposes a tremendous, an enormous burden on society, not just medical, but also financial and emotional. We have some money in the public system.
How much?
Approximately $500 million through federal government, a lot of that at National Institutes of Health. We want to use that money as effectively and as efficiently as possible. And then we are hoping, Diane, that with the release of the plan that we can galvanize more investments, not only financial but also human resources, and stimulate further investments, not just on the public side, but also on the private side as well. We've seen in so many areas of public health where public-private partnerships can really accelerate momentum and financial investments, and that's what we hope this plan will do as well.
So what are you hoping for with the $500 million at hand? Are you looking for more federal funding for Alzheimer's research and its causes? What are you hoping to achieve?
Well, our greatest goal, Diane, is to meet the need. And we understand that so many people are suffering in a devastating way with this condition. And it's affecting not just patients, but also caregivers and families. We understand that we need a broad strategy here that tries to accelerate research, but also services to people in need. We have to coordinate the efforts of people and organizations around this country better. There are many heroes in communities who are working in relative isolation on these issues, and we're hoping this plan will galvanize, support, really integrate these efforts and catalyze action moving forward.
And as one who's deeply familiar with these concerns, it strikes me that there are kind of conflicting things going on here. You've seen states cutting their own Alzheimer's budgets. So how does the federal government make up for that?
Well, what we hope to achieve by finalizing and releasing this plan in the very near future is to align all the efforts. We have some states and communities doing a tremendous work and advancing their efforts. There are other states that are reeling from financial stresses that are moving in a different direction. We're hoping with the first ever national plan that we can align all the forces together, the human resources, the public health commitments, and the research efforts, and help this nation move as one community moving forward in this very important area.
I hope so. Howard Koh, he's Assistant Secretary for Health in the Department of Health and Human Services. Thanks for joining us, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much, Diane.
And turning to you now, Robert Egge, what are you hoping to see in this plan?
Well, we're excited that finally we have the opportunity to deal firsthand and take on the Alzheimer's crisis in a very meaningful way. Right now, we're well aware across the country, Americans, about what the crisis means in terms of families, in terms of their lives, and in terms of the nation as a whole. We see what it means in terms of the burden that families face. Alzheimer's is not just a little memory loss. It is a disease that devastates and breaks families in terms of what's required of them to meet the obligations of caring for people with Alzheimer's and coping with it themselves as they're going through this disease. We also see the financial impact of this disease. It has a tremendous toll for American families as they have to think about how to juggle work as their caregivers and give up their own work sometimes as it hits people earlier in life. And then for the nation as a whole, it has a very strong impact on Medicare and Medicaid. So with all this reason to act, we're excited that now there is, as Assistant Secretary Koh was laying out, the framework to take this on. And so what we're looking for is a comprehensive plan that hits the elements that Howard laid out in terms of, first of all, research. We need to have a way to tackle this disease, but also the care and support, the healthcare system being adapted for people with Alzheimer's, and then public awareness.
And turning to you, Dr. Turner, Alzheimer's has not really received the kind of attention that you believe it should in terms of all the other research into killer diseases out there.
Yes, I would agree with that. I think Alzheimer's disease and dementia in general is one of the most underfunded areas that would have a significant impact on public health, and certainly is deserving of more funding given the cost of the disease.
How does it compare, for example, to monies appropriated to other causes of death, for example, diabetes?
Well, for example, the NIH budget has an annual budget of $6 million for cancer research, and so there's been great progress in cancer treatment in the last several years. In contrast, Alzheimer's disease NIH budget is about $500 million.
So you said $6 billion for...
That's correct.
All right, right. For cancer and $500 million for Alzheimer's.
And Alzheimer's also has a significant impact on public health as far as cost. And so if you look at the investment versus the cost of the disease, then Alzheimer's is severely underfunded.
Do you agree with that, Deborah Rubenstein?
I do agree. As a social worker in an on-the-ground senior service provider, many of the people that we're serving, and I think this is a nationwide trend in the senior service network, have some form of memory loss, dementia, Alzheimer's. And we see every day the toll that that takes, first on the person with the disease, because what happens when someone has a form of dementia is that as they lose their memory and their cognitive ability, they also lose their ability to function independently, something that we hold very dear in this country. Everything from driving to balancing the checkbook to ultimately, if the disease advances, to the very basics of living. And of course, along with that come then the related social losses of no longer being able to fulfill roles that they once held. And then their families, as they're trying to care, are trying to compensate for both that lack of ability to function independently and the changes in roles.
Deborah Rubenstein, she's Director of Consultation, Care Management, and Counseling at Iona Senior Services. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email, your postings on Facebook or tweets. And we're back talking about a hoped-for plan that will affect the millions of Americans who suffer and are diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease every year. The number of those who are affected is expected to rise as the population ages. That also means the cost of treating them, the cost that family caregivers bear, is also expected to rise. The White House is now bringing together a team of experts to lay out a plan that would, we hope, be in effect by 2025 to deal with the broad range of problems that those affected and their family members affected by Alzheimer's. Here in the studio, Deborah Rubenstein of Iona Senior Services, Dr. Scott Turner of the Georgetown University Medical Center, and Robert Egge of the Alzheimer's Association. We'll open the phones very shortly. I look forward to hearing you. Are we, Dr. Turner, in your view, headed for some kind of epidemic?
We are definitely now in an epidemic, and part of this is because of increasing population, and part of it is because of prolonged life expectancies in this country, which are still increasing every year. We also see a higher rate of Alzheimer's disease and dementia in minority populations, and as we know, minorities are now in some places becoming the majority. And so this is also contributing to the epidemic of Alzheimer's disease.
I have heard some indication that there is a relationship between diabetes and Alzheimer's. Is that correct?
That is correct. Having diabetes in midlife or having diabetes for many years increases the risk of having Alzheimer's disease. And we also know that there's an epidemic of obesity and diabetes in this country, which may increase the epidemic of Alzheimer's in the future.
What do you see as that connection? How is it made between diabetes and Alzheimer's?
I don't think we really know exactly what the connection is. There are theorized mechanisms, and one is perhaps an increased risk of stroke or small strokes, but I don't think we really know the answer to that question.
Robert Egge, are there factors in addition to diabetes that can really help us identify who might be at risk for Alzheimer's?
There are, and the greatest risk factor is age. So as we look at, and that ties back into the point that has been made about not only the size of the epidemic today, more than 5 million Americans, but the fact that because we have an aging population now as the baby boomers age, the numbers are going to rise in lockstep with our population. And so we could look to as much as tripling by mid-century. That's why it is so urgent that we act now to get on top of this, not just for the burden today, but for where we're heading. In terms of risk factors, though, I think another point that Scott made that's really important is there's a lot we don't know right now. And so fundamentally, we need to get on top of this so we understand what the mechanisms are and can do something about it. And that's why all of this that we're talking about today really ties together. We need research so that we can provide better care, better guidance today. And we need as well the support that would make a difference immediately.
Deborah Rubenstein, how do we know when someone is simply experiencing memory loss that's sort of normal with the aging process, and when it moves into what we would call the disease process?
Well, I've heard sort of a shorthand that if somebody can remember they forgot, you don't need to be as worried. Of course, it's more complicated than that. When memory loss interferes with functioning in some way that we begin to get concerned.
For example,
it's one thing to forget an occasional appointment, but if somebody is no longer remembering to go to their doctor at all, that might be a sign of a change.
If someone is out driving and perhaps forgets where he or she is going.
Yes, driving is one of the biggest areas of concern. Many families come to us at Iona specifically to consult with someone to say, what do I do? Because here's the challenge. When someone is showing signs of memory loss, what they really need is medical assessment. But often the person with memory loss finds it very difficult to even consider that possibility. Many families come to us to consult and say, how do I talk to mom or dad about getting to see a doctor for the assessment they need? How do I have that very difficult conversation about taking away the keys?
Scott Turner, it used to be that one could only know that an individual suffered from Alzheimer's through autopsy. That's no longer the case. Deborah talked about assessment. Tell me about assessments.
So I would agree with that. Alzheimer's disease is very common, and I think we have a fairly good degree of accuracy, especially in specialty medical clinics, of making a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. With the other dementias, we have a little bit more trouble and less accurate in our diagnosis. But given the history, the clinical examination, the diagnostic testing, I think we can make a fairly accurate assessment of Alzheimer's disease.
Give me a general understanding of that assessment, how you go about it.
Okay, so we bring in the patient and a knowledgeable caregiver. We take a separate history from the patient and the caregiver, which is often very discrepant, as you might imagine. And we hear things like repeating questions, forgetting conversations, forgetting things in general, having difficulty with complex activities of daily living, such as driving and shopping and handling financial affairs and handling daily medications. And this is sort of the typical clinical scenario that we would find. We then order a neuroimaging test, a CAT scan or MRI of the brain.
Something show up?
This is mostly done to rule out other disorders such as strokes or other lesions in the brain, and usually comes back with some atrophy and white matter changes, typically with an early Alzheimer's patient. And we also do our physical examination and memory assessment.
How does that go?
And we test memory in the clinic, memory, language, visuospatial, what are called executive or frontal functions of the brain, planning and foresight and reasoning. And we put all of this together and come up with a diagnosis. And so our diagnosis is often mild dementia due to Alzheimer's disease. Now, I have to recommend that people do come in for an evaluation. There's a lot of negativism out there in the community. The patient will often deny having problems, will say they're just senior moments and they're all my friends are having senior moments. But when it begins to have an effect on function in daily life, and you see this pattern of decline from a previous level, then you begin to get concerned. And I would definitely seek an evaluation, starting with their own healthcare provider, and then perhaps referral if needed. That there is value in getting assessment and diagnosis and treatment.
Is there a way to screen for Alzheimer's?
Well, that's a great question. And so what we emphasize is really you need to know the early warning signs of problems, what to look for. And so one of the great opportunities with the plan right now that's being discussed, that's on the table, is a nationwide awareness campaign. We heard that referenced already, to make people aware of when they should go have these conversations that we've just been talking about. Because that then leads to a diagnosis, and that's the foundation for good, effective care that can be provided today. We had 130 town hall sessions in late summer in support of this activity that's going on now, and spoke to Americans across the country. One of the key things we heard is how important it is and what a missed opportunity it's often been to have an early diagnosis that allows people to get the care and support that's already out there. So we see this as absolutely one of those near-term opportunities from an effective unified plan.
My concern is that there is really no treatment for Alzheimer's. I mean, you can be diagnosed, you can get the care you need, but there's no treatment.
And that has to change, absolutely. That is a fundamental fact that we have to deal with. The fact that of the leading cause of death today, Alzheimer's stands alone as the only one without a cure or a way to prevent or to slow its progression. That said, though, there are very, very important reasons today to get this detection to take place and a diagnosis, whether it's support, more accurate support from healthcare providers. So, for instance, your diabetes that you might have at the same time can be managed more effectively. That's extremely important. So your hospitalization occurs more smoothly. But also the kinds of services that Deborah was referring to in the community, that you know where to get help as a caregiver. Also, you know what to expect and how to deal with these predictable crises that occur as Alzheimer's and other dementias unfold.
Deborah, how do people come to you? What do they say? What are they asking for?
Well, every day when our professionals answer our question and answers helpline, they are hearing people say things like, often it's something like, I'm concerned about my parent or my spouse. Maybe there is already a diagnosis, and I'm not sure what the next steps are. Where do I start? Because this isn't like cancer where there's a whole medical protocol. instead, people need to start doing planning on a variety of fronts. They need to do critical legal and financial planning. They need to think ahead about where they're living and where the person with memory loss is living and what's the best place it's going to be. They need to be educated about the wonderful range of services that are out there in the community. That, I think, is important. It's true that we don't have medical cures for this disease yet, and we need them. But there are many wonderful supports out there in the community. Things like adult day programs, a part of the spectrum of care that lots of folks don't know about. We have a center like this at Iona, and they're all over the country, places where people with dementia can go and find community and support and the services they need, and their caregivers get valuable respite, often allowing people to stay at home for much longer than they otherwise would. So when we get calls, what we're trying to do is to let people know that our organization can provide the services that people need to stay in the community with quality of life.
Deborah Rubenstein, Director of Consultation, Care Management, and Counseling for Iona Senior Services here in Washington, D.C., and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Scott Turner, I said there are no treatments for Alzheimer's. You disagree.
Yes, I would disagree with that statement. Obviously, what we are looking for is better treatments and more effective treatments, and that is what the 2025 deadline for this plan was a very ambitious but hopefully achievable goal. But when we do our evaluation in clinic, we look for other causes of memory problems. And this could be just thyroid disease or vitamin B12 deficiency or perhaps mild depression and other causes. So, and sometimes people are taking medications that could adversely affect their memory. So we screen for those things. And so there, as I said, there is value in getting an evaluation and treatment and getting a correct diagnosis. And
but,
if it is Alzheimer's disease,
yeah,
there are several safe and effective medications that are already FDA approved. And we commonly prescribe these to patients
such
with Alzheimer's, such as Aricept and Razadine and Exelon and Namenda. Which are prescribed and do have some benefit, but obviously we would like to have more effective medications.
And from various doctors I've spoken with, Aricept, Namenda, others of these drugs provide some help, but not a great deal.
That's right. You know, so I agree with everything that's just been said, but it's symptomatic relief, which should not be minimized. That's important. And if that's a tool that works for a time, that's outstanding. But, of course, what everybody's hoping for is a way to stop this disease, and that's what we don't have. And that's what we really need to pursue aggressively.
Once it's diagnosed, is there any way to slow its progress?
There currently is no known way to slow the progress at the moment. We have several treatment strategies in the pipeline. These are called immunotherapies for Alzheimer's disease. We are hopeful that these are targeting amyloid, and this may perhaps slow down the progression of the disease. There's some slight benefit currently from the medications that are now available, but these are more, as we call, symptomatic treatments and not disease-modifying treatments.
So what is available is help for that person in the way of stimulation. Iona Services provides various kinds of classes, activities, that sort of thing, to try to stimulate the activity of the brain.
Yeah, the right environment is a critical treatment and support for someone with memory problems of any kind. In addition, a key piece is the support that they're going to need to compensate for their inability to do things like Dr. Turner mentioned, like manage their own medications. Iona and other organizations are often looking at is helping caregivers locate needed services such as help in the home so that the caregiver isn't on the job 24 hours a day, which no caregiver can do.
What would it take to develop a cure for Alzheimer's, Robert Agee?
Well, I think there's a few different ways to answer that, and I won't try to answer from a scientific perspective. I'll tell you at the Alzheimer's Association, we're working on that question right now in terms of talking to experts like Dr. Turner about what is needed. But I'll answer from a different perspective, which is to say, sort of what kind of commitment do we need to research? We know, it's already been mentioned, that when we have invested in other diseases that have been mentioned, like cancer, like HIV/AIDS, we have made a difference. We've developed those therapies. I think we all agree right now, as we're looking at this problem together in the advisory council, I was at the meeting yesterday, it seems to be a shared sense that we need to do a lot more if we're going to hit that very appropriate goal, of a real deadline by which we're going to change this disease.
And do you believe that commitment is truly there?
You know, I think there is a real wonderful opportunity that's been created by this administration, and we're really looking to see those next steps laid out.
All right. Robert Agee is with the Alzheimer's Association. When we come back, your calls, your comments.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. And by The Poetry Foundation, celebrating 100 years of Poetry Magazine, online at poetryfoundation.org. This is NPR.
A reader's review of The Day of the Jackal by Frederick Forsyth, a thriller about an assassination plot against French President Charles de Gaulle, which set the stage for modern spy novels. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we're back. It's time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Andalusia, Alabama. Good morning, Thomas. You're on the air.
Thanks for the call, Diane.
Sure.
Since Alzheimer's is so closely linked to diabetes, and in some circles, Alzheimer's is even called diabetes of the brain, how can the government ethically consider a treatment plan for Alzheimer's and still subsidize the low-cost, high-glycemic grains that cause diabetes?
It's really an interesting question, Robert Agee.
Yeah, I think the question does point to the need for a holistic approach to this. One of the themes I was mentioned earlier, I want to go back to again in response to this question, which is that we really need to shore up our understanding of what's driving this. And then I think once we have those questions answered, there are going to be really rich policy implications for what we learn.
All right, to Norfolk, Virginia. Good morning, Ian.
Hello, how are you this morning?
Fine, thank you, sir.
Just a couple of comments, a very, very brief story. I ran a business for a number of years, and my mother gave me a call and informed me that my father, who was the former chaplain at Westminster Canterbury, had been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. I immediately shut down the business, spent 2 years as a caregiver for him, and watched him die. After he died, I realized I'd been so ineffective and really did not know enough about giving proper care. It didn't matter what I was giving care for. So I started attending caregiver classes, a number of which are offered through Alzheimer's Association. And I discovered an unbelievable world of really very little knowledge, and certainly, you know, very little knowledge with the, you know, the vast population that we have. So I took a number of courses and then started teaching a course to assisted living facilities and to home-based caregivers. And one of the things I discovered was that even though we're having a difficult time trying to keep up with the illness in terms of science, we are sociologically not prepared to deal with many issues that caregivers have, i.e. anger issues, the ability to recognize when it's important to step back from a problem. And many of our caregivers aren't educated enough to be able to handle these. I took an anger management course, which I found has been fantastic in the teaching.
Interesting. Deborah?
I think these are some excellent points. I've said it before, no caregiver should go through this experience alone. These strong emotional reactions are normal. There's nothing wrong with you as a caregiver if you are experiencing strong feelings, but you need help dealing with them. He's absolutely right. Part of this is education, everything from how do you most effectively communicate as a caregiver with the person you're caring for to dealing with your own feelings, and you must get support. I am a big believer in caregiver support groups, which are places where people can share their experiences and get both practical help and emotional help from others. That's something that Iona and organizations throughout the Senior Service Network and the Alzheimer's Network use, and people should take advantage of them.
Thanks for calling in to Indianapolis. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Diane. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
Great, great, great show. Great show, you guys. My mom has Alzheimer's. It kind of crept up on her real quick. I mean, my mom is the epitome of a person that you wouldn't think that would get Alzheimer's. She exercised. She ate right. You know, she could quote the Bible back and forth, upside down, and all of that. But it came on her at a rapid pace, and we need to speed up. We need to speed up our research on this too, you guys. I mean, I'm going on 56 years old, and us baby boomers are getting right to that edge. And this has been around for quite a while now. I mean, it's not like Alzheimer's just snuck up on us. I know we tried to hide it and say, you know, it's just, oh, you know, the I'm just getting old, I'm starting to forget, and yada yada yada. That's not the point. I look at it like the doctor there said. I think there was a doctor that said it about the holistic approach to this. You know, we need to, I think it's in our diet, it's our environment, it's, you know, because this is just captivating, and it kills you. I mean, it just doesn't impede you, it kills you.
That's a very passionate and understandable statement, Robert Agee. Yeah,
that's right. And, you know, you bring up a few different points there. One is that research, we think about that as always, you know, in the labs with the test tubes in terms of our imagination. There are important areas of research that are contemplated by this plan that deal with how do you provide support as well? How do we rigorously evaluate the best ways to support caregivers? That's a very important theme of this research. But I also, you know, another thing I was struck by with that comment was I think he captures a real growing sense in America that Alzheimer's can't wait. This is the time to tackle this disease. You know, as I look at sort of what the baby boomers have tackled as they've aged, a number of diseases have been focused on and dealt with. I think we're really sensing right now that there's a growing consensus that this is a disease that we've put off too long in taking on.
I think, Chris, like many children of those with Alzheimer's is also worried about himself and whether there might be a genetic factor. Dr. Turner.
Yeah, the major risk factors are getting older, which is aging, and also family history or genetics.
Interesting.
There is one gene that is linked to Alzheimer's disease, which is the APOE4 gene. And I would encourage people to find out about clinical research opportunities that are available right now. If we are to make progress in this disease, we really need more volunteers.
To do what?
To join a clinical research study.
But what does that mean?
So one of them is called ADNI, the Alzheimer's Disease Neuroimaging Initiative. And this is looking to discover biomarkers, new biomarkers of Alzheimer's disease, such as PET scans and proteins in cerebral spinal fluid. This study is across the country and is recruiting right now at many places. In Washington, D.C., we're recruiting at Georgetown and Howard Universities. And this study is begging for patients and volunteers to join, to join the fight to discover new biomarkers.
But help me to understand what those volunteers would be subjected to.
So they would be subjected to history and clinical examinations and MRI, PET scans, spinal fluid collection.
That's the part that bothers me. Really? I mean, how many volunteers are going to be up for spinal fluid collection?
Well, there are many who actually do volunteer, and it is it is like going to the dentist. It's a little bit unpleasant, but it's possible. But we'd certainly need more volunteers if we're going to make progress.
Yeah, that's what we hear a lot is, you know, as you're dealing with this disease, you want to fight back and do something about it. And there are great opportunities to do so across the spectrum. One is just what Scott was laying out in terms of volunteering. At ALZ.org, there's a program called Trial Match. So wherever you are in the country, you can look there and see what opportunities are local for you to participate in these kinds of trials.
All right. Thanks for calling, Chris. Let's go to Linda. She's in Potomac, Maryland. Good morning to you.
Hi, good morning, Diane. I've been taking care of my mother now for 9 years, and she doesn't have Alzheimer's. She has vascular dementia. And something that hasn't been mentioned yet, we've talked about the cost or the investment in research dollars, but the cost to the economy in terms of economic loss is enormous. I was a senior vice president on Wall Street. I had to give up everything to take care of my mother. And thankfully, my husband has an income that can support us right now. But I don't know how other people can do it. Every other day, I have to go to the nursing home and take care of her just to save costs to me because we're running out of money. And every month, you steal from Peter to pay Paul when the bills come in. And it is an unbelievable cost and burden. I haven't been on vacation in years. Every day, every hour of every day, I spend thinking about how am I going to manage my mother. And my mother-in-law is 91. And it's this tsunami coming down. And I think one number that is missing in this conversation is the absolute cost to the economy of what it cost when I left the market, when I left the job market, and what it's cost my family just dollars and cents.
Linda, my heart goes out to you. I think your call represents millions of other people. Robert Agee.
That's right. She does represent millions of people. And there's two ways to look at this cost. And either way, the numbers are so big, it's almost hard to get your hands around them. In terms of what we know as sort of the formal cost, when people actually write a check for, whether it's the government or families, it's $183 billion today. And it's going to skyrocket in the years ahead as the cases skyrocket. But also, you know, there's this other issue that was raised, which is what's the uncounted cost? And we've looked at that. Today, there are 15 million unpaid caregivers in America who are working in these demanding roles, often trying to hold down jobs because they must at the same time. They work 17 billion hours each year in this unpaid capacity. And if you put a price tag on that using the accepted ways to do so, that is also $202 billion per year in this unpaid sort of shadow cost. And then you have the impacts that aren't even rolled in here, like productivity on the job when you've been up all night and you show up the next day and you can't concentrate on what you're doing. All of this is taking a toll on our country.
You know, there are lots of folks, and one of our callers is one, who believe that there are environmental factors going on here, and that's part of what as some people refer to as this silver tsunami that's happening. What could these possible causes in our environment, in our way of living, in what we drink, what we eat. You know, we've talked about diabetes, but it seems to me there's something we're missing.
Well, you know, one way to get a handle on this, because I think there are all these hypotheses, many of them, when they've been evaluated, I'm sure Scott has more to say about this.
For example, aluminum ware.
That's right. That was one of the early ideas years ago. And it's an example of hypotheses that were tested and largely ruled out then in terms of a focus of research based on randomized controlled trials. What we need is an infrastructure for evaluating all these different ideas. Those are, you know, Scott would tell us that the jargon here is a longitudinal trial where you're tracking people over time and can start to see how they're living their lives, what the effects may be, and evaluating these different ideas. There was an evaluation done by the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, recently on Alzheimer's specifically. And what they concluded from this evaluation literature is there isn't much we can say now, but we need to answer these questions. And they had listed a range of the kinds of projects that we as a country should be investing in, and none of them are being done today at the scale that we required.
It's so interesting that HIV/AIDS was thought to be forever a killer disease and is now something that people live with chronically, thanks to drugs, thanks to various kinds of approaches. And yet, all that's come out of Alzheimer's is Aricept or whatever else. But they're not really full treatments.
I would say they are better than no treatment, but
certainly
need...
And that's why I'm asking, with this huge population of people who are suffering from Alzheimer's, why hasn't there been more up to now?
I think one is that it's a more difficult target disease to treat, and also because HIV/AIDS has received much more funding, research funding, and has much more progress has been made in HIV compared to Alzheimer's disease. And so this program is a call for action, is a call for awareness, for increased funding levels, for making progress in this disease. And I think this is really sorely needed.
Here's an email from Laura in Cincinnati. And by the way, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Laura in Cincinnati says, do your guests believe that family care, as well as maintaining familiar surroundings for the patient, staves off progressive movement of this dreadful disease? Deborah.
Well, I know that many families, just as the caller from Potomac, Linda, make extraordinary efforts, in part because that is their belief. And Dr. Turner could talk to the research of this, but I think just we observe that people in familiar surroundings, in association with the people that they love, certainly do better. And that's one of the reasons why these caregivers place such extraordinary effort into looking after the people that they love, even at great personal cost.
I'm going to take one last quick call from Kathleen in Longview, Texas. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I am 54 years old. I was diagnosed with dementia at the age of 50. I would just like to call attention to the fact that absolutely nothing is being done for people like me who have no one to act as a caregiver for them.
You know, I'm so glad we took this call. Today, for what's called younger onset Alzheimer's disease, we estimate there are 200,000 Americans today who are below the age of 65 with Alzheimer's. This in itself would be a major disease, just this group.
Do you think it's different from the aged people who develop dementia? Are these different diseases?
They're really very clinically the same disease. It just happens to affect younger people. And so these often come for reevaluation, second and third opinions.
Do they move more quickly when they're diagnosed at younger
Usually not, unless they have one of the very rare familial mutations that cause Alzheimer's disease. And these can move more quickly, but the typical younger age onset moves at about the same speed.
But you see, she has no children. She has no caregiver, such as a spouse.
I think this raises an important policy issue. There's a senior service network throughout the country, funded in part by the Older Americans Act, that normally serves people 60 and over. We're seeing these younger people who need the kind of services that we offer in the Senior Service Network, and we need to figure out how to make it available to them.
Kathleen in Longview, Texas, I hope you'll search that out and find some help for yourself. Thank you so much for sharing your story. And thanks to you, Robert Egge of the Alzheimer's Association, Deborah Rubenstein of Iona Senior Services, and Dr. Scott Turner of Georgetown University Medical Center. He is looking for volunteers. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Nikki Jex, Susan Neighbors, and Lisa Dunn. And the engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cap.